flagpole, anything that's also got some altitude. When you bring a portion of the wire back down to earth to bring it into a tense spike, a tense stake, even though it's made out of plastic, you're making sort of a sloper antenna fed from the top. You'll have a little bit lower performance than if you can get some altitude. All the altitude you can put into an antenna usually helps when it comes to DX work. With rare exception, you want as much altitude as you can get. Let me drop. So I would try to use some other support if it's available to you. Going down to the ground is not necessarily bad. Obvious by the fact, if you read the latest issue of QST Magazine, the January issue, there's a letter to the editor in there about a guy who had half of his dipole fall down, lay flat on the ground, into the snow, and he didn't have the time to put it back up to get to his net, so he loaded it up anyhow, and it worked like a charm. So as long as the standing wave ratio is not extremely high, as long as your antenna tuner can tolerate it, and you can keep the rig happy, don't worry. It's not going to explode. It's not going to catch on fire. So the main thing you want to do with the antenna is resonate it if you really want the highest performance. And that's what the antenna tuner is doing. It's taking a random length of wire and forcing it into resonance. There's nothing magic about feeding a dipole from the center or from the end. Let me drop. In the case of where do you put the shield, if it was an off-center fed dipole or a center fed dipole, you've got a place to connect the shield. You would like to feed it from one end because the shack is on the second floor and there's a piece of wire coming out of the building, and you'd rather not lose a transmission line. In that case, I would recommend you try to make the wire a even number of quarter wavelengths long, in which case you'll be feeding a high impedance, and therefore you don't have to worry about the shield, as long as you've got the antenna tuner that can tolerate a high impedance. You're going to be experimenting with a number of antennas, quite possibly, Bill. The wire itself for the antenna is not very expensive. The insulators and the methods of mounting it are not very expensive. And so you're not going to be putting up one antenna. Ultimately, you're going to put up a number of antennas, in my opinion. And you, a ham radio operator, let me drop. You see the wire, you look for the wire. In your eye, it's very substantial. A simple piece of wire of the right color. The majority of the public does not see it. People walk around, they look at the sidewalk they're walking on, they look at your lawn, they don't look up in the air, they don't look for wire. So you can put all kinds of wires around your property, and within reason you can get away with it. And you're going to be putting up more than one antenna. You're going to be experimenting. A QRP person is looking for a very efficient antenna because he's running a very low amount of power, usually under 5 watts, and in order to be heard, the antenna better be radiating 4.5 of those watts into space and not wasting it in some other place. There are some darn good books on inexpensive antennas. The ARRL antenna book is one of the places I would start off with, and there's a lot of other books which will give you some good ideas. But the sloper you're describing, it will work, but the extra altitude would work better. These are some of the hints I've got. I know Mel has run into a problem like this. He's probably got a number of suggestions. Let's see what Mel would do in a case like this. K2KEY. Wait for the three beeps. K2RIW.
Thanks, Dave. Mel, anxious to hear your comments.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Very familiar with the 817. Just finished picking one only a few weeks ago. Let me tell you something about the 817. It's a very compact radio, nice working radio, but you've got to be very careful with it. It has no tolerance there for any kind of mistake, especially on a power supply. Let me caution you with that, first of all. If you by mistake reverse the wires on the power supply, it is instant disaster. And or if the power supply, even when it comes on a well-designed switching power supply, whatever, if that voltage for a couple of nanoseconds literally exceeds about 13.8, again, bingo, because that's what happened basically. One of these things did happen to the date 17, and it was a project. Let me tell you something I would never get involved again to repair it. There is a modification that is in QST, and I advise you to do that modification to condition the situation to prevent any kind of this condition arising. Put that modification in. You're a new ham. You may have spent a lot of money if you bought the radio new. So first, do this modification before you go any further. Let me let it drop at this point. Then we'll go on. Over.
Well, let me ask you a quick question on that one, Mel. Because the rig is so persnickety about reverse voltage or higher voltage, would you recommend that Bill put a very heavy wattage 14-volt Zener diode across the 817 to make sure it can't see reverse polarity and can't see more than 14 volts where damage could occur? Would you recommend something like that? K2KEY with three beeps, K2RIW?
Well, it's a lot more than that. First of all, if you put 13, even 13.8 into that radio, it's ridiculous, and I'll tell you why. The regulators in there are either a 9.5 or a 5-volt regulator. So if you put in anything over 10.5 volts, about 10.5 volts, it is making the regulators work overtime. So the modification is twofold. Number one, they have a regulator, an outboard regulator, that drops the voltage. You can set it to whatever you like if you want to use it at 13.8 or whatever. Or you can run it, if you're going to run it off a shell cell, you can run a 10.5 volt shell cell directly. But it's got two things. First of all, it put a bilateral diode in the circuit so that by mistake you do reverse the connection, it immediately will blow the fuse that you put in line. It doesn't have a fuse, remember, in that radio. This is one of the problems. It blew on the board. It blew a number of what they call circuit protects. They got these things called CPs. These are little things that are the size of your pencil. Circuit protects are misery to replace. Anything's a misery to replace in that. And it's very costly when you go back to the company to repair these radios because they will hold you responsible if any of these things are burned out. They will void the warranty. So this circuit that's in QST, one, reduces the voltage into the radio up to 10.5 maximum, and depending on any of the power supplies that you use, plus it makes it so that it is impervious to a reversal by mistake of the power supply takeover.
Comment.
Wesley recognized. But my first question, Mel, what is the recommended voltage for that rig? I mean, most of the solid-state rigs we use are made to run on 12 volts. It sounds to me like this is made to run on something like 10.5 volts. Rather unusual. What is the recommended voltage range going into that rig? Mel first, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Actually, 10.5. That's according to this article, and this gentleman that did quite a bit of research on it actually did communicate with Yaesu that the built-in, they actually designed it to be run initially on the built-in battery pack, to use the battery pack that is available, that is part of, in other words, that actually does have provision for a built-in battery pack, which runs at 10.5. Anything over 10.5 is wasted energy, Dick, over.
Question.
Interesting, very unusual. Okay, we got a number of people waiting here. Wesley was the first one. N2XJN, go ahead, Wesley. Wait for the beeps. K2RIW.
Okay, this is N2XJN. I have performed a few quite good modifications in this radio, the FT817ND. Now, that's what the gentleman was talking about the green wire modification. You can use with if you use a if you use the power supply that is not specified by the ESO, you might have a problem with charging the batteries. You want to, let's say, put the batteries, the rechargeable batteries. The recommended is to install 2 to 3 amps fuses. And the best is if you not only install the fuse on the red wire, which is the positive, but also in the negative one. Now, another modification that is very easy to be done is by pressing, of course everything is to be done on the risk of the owner of the radio. I don't take any responsibility for it. If you press 3 buttons, A, B, C, simultaneously, you get to the hidden menu. And then you have menu 01, 02, whatever. Now, if you start from 02 menu, you're going to find out that 02, 03, 04, and 05, I believe, it
repeater, timeout.
The while increasing with a big knob, that number, you actually make the radio more sensitive. And another question that I pick up on the frequency when I was talking to Alex was whether that presents the risk to the MOSFET. If, let's say, I have a stronger signal. But it really works. I've got this radio so sensitive that with the rubber duck antenna, I'm receiving what I was never dreamed about to receive. So 02, 03, 04, and whatsoever simply states for sensitivity on each band. Another problem that I did have with this radio was that this radio is very vulnerable to shakes, to undelicate treatment. And I had a problem with the power plug, which actually, if you put that plug to the back of the radio and you bend it a few times, you might simply create that internal part of the positive from inside that radio will actually unsolder, what happened to me, and I had to solder it. It was very difficult. And a modification drop for a
repeater, timeout.
Okay. That some of the radios could be modified in the frequency range. I've got this radio from Europe, from Poland, as an exchange for my 607 ICOM. And it had the frequencies that are allowed in Europe. For that point, people want to, even in American version, you want to extend to the Mars frequencies, then there is a set of the jumpers that you have to take care of, and they are when you take off the front panel completely, unscrew the ribbon cable, and there are two sets of numbers. One is the red one, one is the blue one, in all of the modifications presented. And in my particular situation, the jumper 8, 7, and 6, let me check for that, there were two jumpers that I simply cross, and that allows me to extend the frequency, so I'm able to use this radio in the United States right now. And that's all I can say about this radio. Back to you, Andrew.
Okay, then get back to me, Dick.
Yeah, we got to be careful about the 90-second timer, Alex. You timed out the machine twice. So we lost a little bit of that, but to paraphrase, by way of the jumpers and by way of the pressing ABC button and getting into menu number 1, 2, and 3, there's lots of modifications you can make to that rig to accommodate European frequencies, American frequencies, Mars frequencies, and so on. I'm getting the impression it has a significant microprocessor that has a lot of capability that may not always be known. So I know we got a little bit off of your original subject of, Bill, of antenna recommendations, and I know we didn't give you a clear indication of exactly what antenna you should build, and that's going to be a bit of a factor of your particular layout, what high objects you've got nearby, and so on. And prepare yourself for the fact that most likely you're going to be building a number of antennas and running experiments with them as time goes on. And whether you disconnect the old antenna before you add the new one, that's your choice. But we amateurs do a lot of antenna tinkering. KC2SYL. Wait for the three beeps, so Bill, KQRIW. Don't try to go over 90 seconds, even though we do. You got it, Bill.
See, Dick.
Thanks, Dick, and Wesley, thanks for the info. Right now I'm running the battery, I'm sorry, I'm running the radio off the battery. I haven't attached it to a power supply. I did call Yaesu about the radio, and I strongly recommended do not use a switching power supply. I'll repeat that again. Do not use a switching power supply because of the voltage changes. I haven't purchased a regulated power supply, but that's down the road. And I do appreciate the word about the antennas. The spools of wires are relatively inexpensive, so I figure I can have a whole bunch of them, just wrap them around something and carry them with me. And I appreciate the hidden menus. I haven't investigated that, but I will. The Mars frequencies, if you can just, I know I should know this, but I don't. If you just indicate what the ranges are. Thanks. Back to that.
VX5WRQ.
Yeah, those Mars frequencies, quite possibly Mel knows those. Mel, K2KEY with a delay, K2RIW.
Oh, I think they may have changed some of this from my time when I was involved with Mars in the military, so I had a lot of experience with Mars at the time. Most of my operating was teletype messages that I sent and received on 80 meters, and the low was 3.5, about 3.495, I remember that, 3.495, I operated Mars and RTTY, that was Army Mars frequency. I would suggest that you look in June, write this down, June, and QST June 2005. Look in that issue. Read very carefully that issue on the FD-817 modification. It's not a complicated job to modify it. And I would suggest you do that because you'll wind up with, I heard a lot of horror stories which were confirmed, you'll see in the June issue, about how many of the Yaesu FD-817 have gone the way of literally garbage pile that I actually did rescue this one from. Look in that June issue and you'll see the whole story on it. Very, very informative. Let me let it drop and I'll talk about antennas and QRP.
And I have a comment on this.
We are kills and must.
Another comment.
Okay, he gets everybody. Just hang on one second. QRP, a lot of people have the misconception that if you're running QRP, that you have to use a QRP type of antenna. That is the opposite. A lot of people get very discouraged in running QRP because they don't make many contacts, and or whatever they make is far and few between. Very frustrating when you call somebody and they don't come back to you because they don't hear you. Unless, you know, really perfectly clear with great propagation and all. So, the use of an excellent antenna is whatever possible is recommended for QRP. I've had a lot of fun with the QRP antenna hooked to a good antenna system that I have and have been able to work into Europe with that 817 down into South America and whatnot. But using a excellent antenna, whereas the person who had it before he worked it out, he used it very seldom. I guess part of the destruction of it was got discouraged with it that he couldn't make any contact because he had a less than the ideal antenna. Let me let it drop for a second. So if you can look for a better antenna there that will work somewhat, you know, for QRP, I could say, you'll not have the results of it that will be really desirable. So, what you were describing, I don't think is going to give you the kind of results that you will be happy with the QRP. That's basically all I can say about experiences with the QRP rig. And as Alex said, it's got menus and sub-menus, and I had my hands full with it because I had to redo everything in that radio. Go ahead, Dick.
Sounds like a nice compact radio, but you gotta be careful. Okay, we had a number of people who wanted to make comments. Who was the first person who said comment? Give me a call letters, please. KQRIW.
This is VX5 WRQ deck.
Wesley.
Yeah, Wesley recognized, but John, go right ahead with your comment.
I've actually read up on that. I mean, I've got to be honest, I've been out of the loop with ham radios, and I'm probably not going to get back on because I'm training a new hammy in progress, the one who's taking the test tomorrow. Anyways, as goes with those modifications to Mars frequencies, I got to dig up a book, but I do recall that there's a bunch of mods you could do to portable units, the old school ones. As goes with now, my question is, the Yaesu FT-270R that I have right now, what can be done modification-wise, because I'm trying to find mods.
Yeah, I seem to remember there's a website for Yaesu rigs, or for, I think Yaesu rigs. I think there's a website where people gather a lot of that information. I wonder if you know about that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Oh, yeah, there's a number of websites that have to Google it. There's a lot of information that has come up on there. In fact, in that article in June 2005, I believe he mentioned where a number of the information on Yaesu equipment, especially if you look down the line on 817, FT-817, and you will see, you know, a lot of information that is not contained in the manual. As far as using it on the frequency methods of shortcut methods of it working with the menu. As Alex said, that menu is really involved. You got a menu and you got a sub-menu. You got a very complicated system of how this thing really works. Until you really get into it, you don't realize what they jammed into this little box. So I suggest, that's why I suggest, go to June 2005 first. Of QFC, and then take it from there. There's a lot of great information there, Dick, over.
Yeah, the slight problem, though, is that John is now asking about a FT-270R, not necessarily the 817. There is a website somewhere where people gather information on the Yaesu rigs. And so I don't know where it is, but at least you know to start looking for one, John. And I hope you find it. You will. It's just a matter of time of finding the website where people gather all this information, the recommended changes and quirks and whatever of these rigs. I know that Wesley wanted to make a comment, so I'll turn it over to him next. Into XJN. Wait for the beep and worry about the 90 seconds there, Wesley. K2RIW.
Into XJN. The first, the modification that is the easiest to be done for 817, and it works, really works, and I recommend that, but it's of course on your own risk. You're pushing A, B, C simultaneously. Then you're gonna see the hidden menu. And there are about 57 different settings. You start with number 5, which is for 2 meter. The value of your radio might be different from that one. It is given here 79. Mine was 176. The maximum is 300. Go all the way to 300, then go all the way almost to zero, and observe the signal that you're receiving. You're going to see the difference. The menu number 4, number 3, and number 2 are responsible for different bands. And as I can recall, menu number 3 was for the frequency of 28 megahertz. Menu number 2 was, I believe, the 3.5 and 7. That's what I recommend. Now, additional thing is, when you try to open up the band, for no matter...
Repeater, time out.
You timed it out again, Wesley. And Wesley, you're repeating this information you gave him once before, and we've got to go on to the next person. I'm sorry. I wonder if you got any final questions, Bill, before we go over to the next person. KC2SYL, K2RIW.
This is KC2SYL. None at this time. Probably a Yahoo group in Yazoo. For Yazoo, you have to look it up in Yahoo. I'm sure there is one. But I do appreciate the hidden menus. I'll look into that in the June 2005 QST. I am a member of ARRL, so I should be able to see that online. Thanks for the info, and I look forward to the experimentation, and once I do a couple of experiments, I'll get back to you. This is KC2SYL, back to Ned.
N2RDB. N2RDB, recognize. Bill, not only does QST, if you're a member, allow you to see all the past articles, but if you go to a good-sized library, they should have back issues of QST magazine, and some of your friends probably have one. N2RDB, start off with your name, sir, and there's a list of people we've got to go through, so if you've got a question on a new subject, I'm going to put you on the list. If you're going to make a comment on the subject that's on the floor, go right ahead. N2RDB, please start off with your name. My name is Dick, K2RIW. Wait for the 3 beeps, and look out for the 90 seconds.
Name here is Tim, that's Tango India Mike. Regarding the 817ND, I own one. Best way to protect against reverse polarity is in whatever cable you have going to the unit, install a full wave bridge rectifier in a little box, maybe a little piece of circuit board inside that box. Hey, we're hams, aren't we? We can do this stuff. And as far as an antenna, a good field antenna is a 50-foot piece of 450-ohm ladder line, cut in half, soldered together at both ends, and fed with a coax connector. Now, you've soldered the end of this here piece of ladder line together, and the center points that connect to the coax connector. I'll let it drop a moment. Then, 16.4 feet out from each centerpiece, you cut a little notch out of one side of the ladder line, and you have a dipole that will work on 20 and 40 meters without a tuner, which, if you're on QRP with a backpacker rig like that, you want something you can roll up and throw in your backpack, that's the antenna to build. Do any power protection circuits outboard. That way you don't void the warranty. N2RDB, back to net.
I thank you for that information, Tim. That folded dipole made out of ladder line, do you remember where the reference for that antenna was, Tim? Go ahead.
W2IK's home pages.
Okay. Whiskey 2 India Quebec, is that what you said? W2IQ home pages. So if I go to whiskey2indiaquebec.com.net.org or just Google Whiskey 2 India Quebec, will that allow me to find his home page? Back to you, Tim.
Negative. Whiskey 2 India Kilo. He does have a .com site. I don't know if that design is on it. It was on his old AOL homepages before they wiped out the AOL homepages and all his information with it. I happened to write down the design before those pages were lost to oblivion. And I believe there is a notice on his website that he is eventually bringing all that back.
Okay, so his call letters are Whiskey 2 India Kilo. And the easiest way of finding his webpage, do I just simply Google Whiskey 2 India Kilo? Will that find him for me? Go ahead.
Whiskey2IndiaKilo.com is his webpage. The design was on the AOL homepages back when he had them, before AOL rather abruptly discontinued that feature.
Okay, got a lot more understanding now, Bill. Tim, I thank you for that information. Okay, the next person on the list was John, if we haven't put him to sleep. WA2 Victor Delta Hotel. You still there, John? K2RIW.
Yeah, that's VX5WRQ. Yeah, I'm still here, and I'm not sleeping. Very interesting conversation, and I'm getting a lot of knowledge, man. I've been out of the loop. I got the young soon-to-be operator listening right next to me. I'm getting him ready to go into a whole new world over here, dive in. I actually had one question for you guys. I just wanted to know, we just hooked up the MH57 ICOM speaker mic. Just want to know how the audio is sounding right now. Is it a difference?
Yeah, we got a little bit of confusion here. There's more than one John. I was passing it over to the other John. That mic sounds good, WRQ. And do I hear a difference? No, I do not. Sounds equally as good as the other one. Now, John number one was Whiskey Alpha 2 Victor Delta Hotel. John number one, are you still there? K2RIW.
Yeah, fine business, Vic. Yeah, I'm still here, and I'm listening and learning. And I, for one, appreciate the long-winded descriptions and the long-winded discussion, so there's no problem. As I said, I'm just listening and learning. Actually, I just had a comment, and I guess this may be somewhat off-topic. Maybe this comment should be reserved for the space discussion. But this comment goes back to the discussion about lightning that we had, I think it was about 2 or 3 months ago. Let me let it drop.
John, you were one of the original guys signing in. You're allowed to ask a question on any subject. You're not forced into the subject on the floor, if you know what I mean. Ask a question on any subject, John. Go right ahead.
Okay, fine. This is, as I say, it's not really a question, just a comment. This is from the Science News magazine of December 5th. Has to do with lightning. The comment is that about the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope, and the article describes how it has detected gamma ray flashes from terrestrial lightning storms. That indicating also evidence of positrons, which I guess is the anti-electron or antimatter electron, been detected in terrestrial lightning bursts and lightning storms. As I said, this is from Science News, December 5th. The article is on page 9 if I want to really read all of the details. But as I say, it's just an interesting addendum to that lightning discussion that we had a few months ago. Go ahead.
I was waiting for the next beep. You brought up a darn interesting subject, John. This all got started, let me think now, I believe in the mid-60s. There was a strategic arms limitation agreement between the Soviet Union and the United States. And in order to monitor whether or not violation of that treaty was taking place, the United States put up a series of satellites called VELA, V-E-L-A. These were gamma ray detecting satellites based on the assumption that a nuclear device that is being detonated will give out a burst of gamma rays. So therefore, the United States put up this network of these satellites. Pretty soon the satellites started detecting gamma ray bursts, and the United States started making accusations to the Soviet Union that they were violating the treaty. And the Soviets said, no way, we're not violating the treaty. Pretty soon, as they gathered more data with those satellites, they suddenly realized that there were times when the satellites were on opposite sides of the Earth and still picking up the signal. And the gamma rays do not penetrate the Earth. Let me drop. That was the very beginning of detecting gamma ray bursts in space. Turns out that there's some really potent events taking place in other galaxies where a gamma ray burst takes place, and they're really potent. On top of that, in the North Pacific, you get some extremely large lightning bursts of numbers like 150,000 amperes. When you get that much energy being dissipated over that number of microseconds, it also makes a gamma ray burst. So the gamma ray detecting satellites can detect certain very high power lightning bolts, certain events going on in space, as well as the detonation of a nuclear device. As you go to higher and higher energy, let me drop. As the device that you're setting off generates a larger and larger amount of energy, it creates a spectrum that has more and more energy at shorter and shorter wavelengths. And as you go through the whole electromagnetic spectrum, you can start off with radio, very far infrared, microwave radio, near infrared, optical, near ultraviolet, far ultraviolet, X-ray, soft X-ray, hard X-ray, gamma ray, cosmic ray. I'm talking about the continuous spectrum of increasing frequency or decreasing wavelength, or another way of saying is that each individual photon of the energy being created or transmitted has more and more energy because it's a shorter and shorter wavelength. That's just the way things work, the way the spectrum works. So lightning can do it, quite a few other things can do it, and as we detect the right kind of direction-finding satellites with certain energy sensitivities, we're finding all kinds of things going on, both on the Earth and out into space. Maybe that's sort of what you're indicating there, John. WA2VDH, K2RIW, wait for the three beeps, and don't exceed the 90 seconds like I just did.
Yeah, fine, this is Dick. I do remember the VELA satellites, V-E-L-A. I think I remember reading about those years ago. I think they were them for a while, as you said. This article also indicates that there is even evidence of antimatter, that is positron and electron pair, positron electron pairs being generated. So looks like there's a lot more to lightning than I guess that meets the eye. Hi. Go ahead, Dick.
The vast majority of lightning bolts occur because the lower portion of the cloud is negatively charged, the upper portion of the cloud is positively charged, and the actual lightning bolt that strikes the Earth usually is starting off negative polarity from the cloud. However, a small percentage of the thunderstorms that we experience have so-called positive lightning bolts. Those are the ones that are about 10 times louder, 10 times more potent, 10 times more lethal. So one storm in 10 or so will be positive lightning bolts, and you can tell the difference right away because every one of them is so darn loud it'll scare the daylights out of you. And whether or not they've also got reverse polarity particles being created doesn't surprise me. When the astronauts, let me drop, on the International Space Station watch a thunderstorm from the top side of the atmosphere, they see very different things. They take pictures of these sprites, I think they're called, In other words, every so often you see red and blue flashes above the atmosphere, above a lightning storm. Back in the days when I was, television receive only terminal, my satellite receiving system with a 12-foot dish was working correctly, and I used to watch a NASA-produced program called NASA Select, and during the time that a space shuttle, during the time that a space shuttle is active, quite often during the time the astronauts are sleeping, they will set up the camera looking at the Earth, and that information is being transmitted down to NASA headquarters live, and the person with the right kind of a satellite receiving system can watch that. I remember one night getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning. The space shuttle was flying over South America. A thunderstorm was taking place in Brazil, and it was a thunderstorm that covered almost the whole darn country. And to watch those flashes topside is kind of exciting, because the flashes appear to be coupled to each other. In other words, all of Brazil was quiet for about 5 seconds, and then a lightning flash would happen in northern Brazil, and almost instantaneously, 3 or 4 lightning flashes would take place in other portions of Brazil to somehow couple together. And whether or not it is the ultraviolet or other emission from the first lightning bolt triggering the others is an interesting question. Also, there are people who believe that you get the... There are people who believe that you get a charged cloud that is ready to create a lightning bolt, and the initiating event is a cosmic ray that comes along, ionizing a path in the atmosphere that initiates the lightning bolt. So one theory is that these lightning bolts are coupled because somewhere in space a burst of a star took place. It created a great big cloud of cosmic rays. The cosmic rays penetrated the Earth's atmosphere, and therefore each of the clouds that were about ready to fire all saw different portions of this cloud of cosmic rays that came in at that instant of time, and therefore that gives you the appearance of all these lightning bolts being coupled, all going off at approximately the same time. So that's another one of the theories. You'll also notice that lightning bolts are almost always zigzagged. And each of those zigzags is roughly 50 meters long, each straight section. Each one of those straight sections takes a microsecond or so to form, and then there's enough voltage to arc the air for 50 meters. Then that particular ionized path waits for the next cosmic ray to come along to create another path in order to create the next portion of the zigzag. So one explanation for why lightning bolts are always zigzag is because...
Repeater, time out.
It is a succession of individual cosmic rays that are all connected together eventually by that lightning bolt that you see. That also gives partial explanation for when you take photography of lightning flashes. Quite often it looks like an upside-down tree, and some of the branches of the tree don't reach the ground. Some of the branches do, and some of them don't. The ones that didn't were not lucky enough to have another cosmic ray come along in order to complete the process. That's part of the guesses as to what's going on. Lightning is a very complicated phenomena, as you can tell, John. WA2, Victor Delta Hotel, K2RIW, wait for the three beeps.
Fine business, Dick. Interesting fact is that the article also mentions that those reverse polarity strokes are the ones that seem to be producing these bursts, and that these are the ones with the higher energy. Just as one final question, that 50-meter distance, that 50-meter average distance, is that some kind of mean free path between ionization particles or something like that? Or is that like an average distance between the ionization events? Go ahead.
The actual mean free path of the ionized air molecules is probably micro inches. It turns out that when you study the amount of voltage in a cloud, you study the length of a lightning bolt, you calculate how many millions of volts are required, because air has a dielectric strength of roughly 30,000 volts per centimeter. You exceed 30,000 volts per centimeter, and you will get an arc most of the time. You study the voltage you've got in the cloud and the distance it's got to cover, and you say, it can't do it. The voltage is not there. It's shy by 10 to 1 in proper voltage. What's happening is that usually the cloud has enough voltage to arc a 50-meter length of air. It doesn't have enough voltage to go beyond that point. So the first cosmic ray comes along, initiates the event. It ionizes a path 50 meters long on average. It doesn't have enough voltage to go any higher. It waits for the next cosmic ray to come along that connects to the first path, and now the two paths continue the discharge from that cloud. The cloud has a whole lot of excess charge, and not all of it flows into that first segment of the lightning bolt. That's one possible explanation. Guarantee it's oversimplified. Guarantee there's more going on. But the approximate 50 meters for the average straight length of each section of the lightning path is because of a voltage limited
repeater. Time out.
It's because of a voltage limitation. That seems to be the best explanation that anyone has given me so far. Back to you, John. W2VDH, K2RIW.
Okay, fine business, Vic. Yeah, very good. This is a very interesting discussion, and I'm going to keep an eye out for future articles on this. I really love this magazine, Science News. They usually have quite a range of topics, so I'm gonna keep an eye out for future articles. Okay, Dick, I'm gonna turn it back to you in that control, so see what the next question is.
Comment.
Gonna go to Wesley in a minute with a comment. When you study high voltage and arcing, and I've been doing that starting about 3 years ago, the people who build a Van de Graaff generator, Tesla, a Tesla coil. The people who build a Tesla coil are experiencing some very nice high voltage arcing in air. That's the good news. But the Tesla coil puts out AC voltage. They only get a chance to see half of what's going on. Let me drop. When you use a machine that puts out DC high voltage, like a Wimshurst generator or a Van de Graaff generator, you see some very different phenomena. In the case of a Wimshurst machine, where you've got these two great big long probes out in front of the machine, and when I carefully tune my particular Wimshurst generator, that's the one with the two great big pie plates and a whole bunch of metallic strips, and the two pie plates, they look like pie plates. They're plastic sheets that rotate in opposite directions. Let me drop. When you get one of those very clean and very carefully tuned, they can approach 200,000 volts, 200 kilovolts. And depending on whether you study the phenomena at the positive lead or the negative lead, you'll see some very different phenomena. So a person with a Tesla coil, which is AC, or some of these other spark generators, they're missing out on an awful lot of the fancy phenomena. I won't go into that right now. That's another whole crazy discussion. Wesley, N2XJN, go right ahead with your comment. Worry about the 90 seconds. K2RIW.
N2XJN. First of all, this is not true that gamma rays do not penetrate the surface of the Earth. The story that you gave about the conflict is quite different than from that you described. Let me drop for a moment. At first, Russian find out, not having the satellites, that when they can, that they take plastic garbage bags, and on the top of that they put a photo tube. The plastic sheets, how to say it, scintillates the particle when the particle strikes. then the American, that was the statement of the Russia. American spies find out about that, and Los Alamos National Laboratory starts a project called Tsiganos. And I believe the Russian one was called Svoboda. And they start to do the same techniques. Back to you, Dr. Jay. I'm sorry. And it was always done in moonless nights when there was no moon. Back to you, Dr. Jay.
Okay. My understanding was that a detonation of a below-ground nuclear device will give you a certain amount of gamma rays that reach the surface and can be detected by a satellite. But my understanding is that the gamma rays cannot penetrate the total Earth. In other words, if I had a detector on this side of the Earth, it may not be able to detect the gamma rays from a nuclear detonation on the opposite side of the Earth. Now, I am a little bit curious as to why the testing of a nuclear device should or should not take place on a moonless night.
At 8 o'clock. Net tonight at 8 o'clock.
Well, why on the moonless night? Give me a couple of words on that one, Wesley. Back to you, Wesley, K2RIW.
For Russians, in order to defend themselves for the possible accusation, whatever accusation there were at that time, they were trying to prove, and you're right, the gamma rays cannot penetrate, at least that's the statement. How the science thinks about it is a different story, because we have very much different opinion about that. But Russian took these devices, let me jump for a moment, and they were trying in the moonless light to find the dim blue flash from that energy that was left over from this violent whatever collisions in the galaxy. And that was why they were able to defend themselves. Then they claim, I'm not saying that was true, but they claim that the American spies find out about these scans, and then actually have made, the Los Alamos National Laboratory made the copy of the Russian device and started Tsiganos experiment. I don't know how to spell it, Tsiganos. S-Y-G-N-U-S, something like that. Right, back to you.
Yes, Cygnus. I think it's pronounced Cygnus. The Vela satellites, when they had a constellation of those in orbit, and when the Vela satellites on opposite side of the Earth were seeing a gamma ray burst simultaneously, that gave them a strong clue that it was not a terrestrial event. It was an extraterrestrial event. That's how they first discovered gamma ray bursts taking place in the universe. And that's a whole separate kind of, let's call it astronomy. You can build astronomy. Let me drop. You can build astronomy detectors for infrared, optical, ultraviolet, X-ray, gamma ray, and so on. As you build more and more space-based telescopes for these various frequency regions or energy events, you could say, you develop a very different picture of what the universe is like. And so these gamma ray bursts are extremely energetic events. One of the theories is that a binary star system where at least one of the stars is a neutron star, when the two stars finally come together, that is one possible explanation for a gamma ray burst. Another possible explanation is a particular kind of a star at the end of its life becoming a supernova. And there probably are other explanations, but be thankful that the gamma ray burst in space, let me drop, on average, it's only one per century per galaxy. Thank goodness their frequency is that low, because if it was much, much higher, and if one took place any closer than about 20 or 30 light years of where the Earth is, it would be highly damaging to all life. So there are people who think that some of the five mass extinctions of life on Earth that have happened over the years, over the life of the Earth, there's been a number of events where almost all plants and animals died and everything starts all over again. Well, what caused it? Was it a asteroid or comet that crashed into the Earth? Was it a gamma ray burst? Was it some kind of a unusual event of the sun? There's all kinds of possible theories as to what has caused those mass extinctions, but they have occurred. And one of the last ones was roughly 65 million years ago, when suddenly all the dinosaurs died and a lot of other things died at the same time. I'm not sure that we've got a very clean answer yet as to what caused that. The next person who was on the list, I think, was W-O-2-N. And I think his name is Bernie. If you're still there, sir, go right ahead. And I think you had a question or a comment. K-2-R-I-W.
All right, thanks, Dick. Yeah, still hanging in here. Just change the subject just a little bit. Question is electrical with a generator, a portable generator. Question is, can I, or would it be right to, like if I have it in the garage, to run a jumper from the generator, in other words, a plug extension, two males, and of course shutting, you know, light or the main off the box. Feed, would it be electrically right, I don't know, to back feed it, like feed a generator into an outlet, 20 amp outlet, back feed the one leg into the box, and put current in that way, you know, feeding one leg back, back feeding instead of, you know, like wiring it through a transit switch, or wiring, you know, run 150 foot cord down, length down to the box itself. Back feeding is using the wiring to get to the box to feed the one phase, and you know, in case like power at it just to get a couple of things up.
Very dangerous, probably against code, and you'd have a tremendous voltage drop in 2 hours, so. Please agree.
Thank you, in 2 hours, so. Yeah, the recommended procedure, Bernie, is to have a three-wire unit. It'd be nice if your generator put out 220 volts, in other words, two phases of 110 with a neutral between the two, and that gets wired to a transfer switch at your main circuit breaker. That's the proper way to do it. Unfortunately, that transfer switch is about a $300 item. It's quite a bit of elaborate wiring. The external generator only gets used a couple of times per decade. Because lately our power is fairly reliable, and therefore it's not as easy to justify the full installation. Let me drop it, I'll tell you more. Now, when it comes to back feeding an external outside socket rated for 20 amperes, I have done that on about 4 or 5 occasions. When I do it, I am well aware I am violating code, and there are ways that I can give myself an awful lot of trouble doing that. I first pull the main circuit breaker between me and LIPA, in my case, and when I backfeed a single circuit, it only feeds the power to half my house. Then by putting another jumper between the A circuit and the B circuit, I can power the whole house. I've done it. It works. But you got to be awfully careful. I do recommend you put a well-established local ground on that generator, because if you do something wrong, the whole darn case of the generator can become hot. You stand on the wet lawn, and in order to save time, you want to put some gasoline in the generator while it's running. The generator itself is hot voltage-wise. The generator, if you don't do things just right, you can easily have the generator 120 volts away from ground. Let me drop for a second. You stand on that wet grass and you touch that metal generator while it's running. your life is at risk. So you got to be awfully careful. I'm saying I don't recommend it, and it's against code. I have done it. Here I am admitting I've done it.